Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the new film Kill the Messenger tells the story of investigative journalist Gary Webb, whose 1996 Dark Alliance series exposed links between drug traffickers and the U.S.-backed Contras in Nicaragua. Prestige outlets like the New York Times devoted serious resources to going after Webb in an attempt to discredit his reporting. We'll go back to the Counterspin archives to hear from Webb himself. Also on the show, you might think you hear enough about abortion in the press. A new book says we need to talk about abortion differently. Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights, is the latest from author, poet, and Nation columnist Katha Pollitt. We'll talk with her about reframing that conversation. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
60 Minutes might still have a reputation as one of the few remaining homes to tough investigative journalism, but they're working hard to make viewers forget that history. Last year, the show ran a fawning profile of outgoing CIA official Mike Morrell, who just so happens to now work for CBS. Before that was a puff piece on the National Security Agency, and now an October 5th profile of FBI Director James Comey, which sounded more or less like a commercial for the agency. The FBI is working hard to prevent cybercrime and to track ISIS terrorists. Comey, we learn, prefers the term lone rat to lone wolf when referring to potential homegrown terrorist threats. And CBS was proud to note that they got access to places not usually accessible to TV cameras for their scrutiny-free segment. If the point was to present the FBI as in control and on top of any potential threats, CBS did what it set out to do. There are tough questions that could be asked of the FBI on topics ranging from Patriot Act abuses to attacks on whistleblowers and journalists. 60 Minutes had a different kind of journalism in mind.
On October 1st, the PBS NewsHour provided Republican Representative Paul Ryan another chance to explain how his ideas about deep spending cuts on social programs combined with tax breaks for the wealthy constitute an anti-poverty program. Well, that shouldn't be easy, but Ryan gets a lot of help from corporate media in the form of vague, euphemistic language that obscures rather than reveals, as when a PBS segment described Ryan's idea of slashing Medicare benefits as a plan to, quote, impose changes for future Medicare recipients to hold down costs, close quote. Well, on this recent show, Judy Woodruff posed this question.
You talk about the Republican Party, how it needs to open up. But I guess one of my questions to you is how hard is that to do when many, certainly Democrats, some independents, see the Republican Party as a party that has at least in the past been perceived as against doing programs for the poor, against expanding Medicaid, health benefits. How do you see the challenge for the Republican Party?
Do you follow that? Many people, and especially those in opposing political parties, see the GOP as having been perceived, at least in the past, as against programs for the poor and the expansion of Medicaid benefits. But these aren't perceptions held by Ryan's opponents about the past. They're facts observed by anyone who observes facts about the Republican Party today. As of December 2013, as USA Today reported, all 20 of the states choosing not to expand Medicaid have Republican governors. And if calling for steep cuts in spending on food stamps, Pell Grants, and other benefits for low-income groups isn't being against doing programs for the poor, it's hard to see what would be. That kind of mealy-mouthed talk no doubt encourages Ryan to keep appearing on the NewsHour, but it does no favors for the show's viewers.
On October 8th, NPR's Morning Edition set out to do something unusual, to go back and challenge some rhetoric from a recent interview with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Unfortunately, the show turned to a single guest who basically agreed with Netanyahu's take. The issue is what to call illegal Israeli settlement building in East Jerusalem. Netanyahu said on the show they're not settlements, those are neighborhoods. So host Steve Inskeep set things up like this.
It matters a lot to Israelis and Palestinians alike just what things are called. The differences in language suggest differences in ways of seeing the issue on the ground.
Well, this is certainly true, but what you call something depends on what it is. In this case, the overwhelming international consensus is that occupying and settling your own citizens in land conquered in war is a violation of the Geneva Conventions. But instead of that perspective, NPR went to Israeli newspaper columnist Ari Shavit. He told Morning Edition that most Israelis agree with Netanyahu about this particular settlement, and the real problem is that both sides use troubling language. So somehow a discussion about how Israel has recast its illegal occupation as the construction of neighborhoods turned into a lament about how both sides are being misleading. Inskeep mentioned near the top of the segment that this was just, quote, one perspective on the political wording in the Mideast, close quote. Well, let's hope that Morning Edition is planning on taking another crack at this, perhaps with a guest that will actually challenge Netanyahu's spin about settlements and tell listeners what international law says about it.
Elite media continue to encourage Americans to believe press accounts and not their lying eyes when it comes to the economy. It results in some disorienting reporting. An October 3rd Washington Post story opens like this. Quote, the U.S. economy is back on solid ground 6 years after the Great Recession, new data showed Friday. But President Obama and other Democrats are struggling to convince voters ahead of the midterm elections that they deserve the credit for the rebound, close quote. Okay, but the person who wrote the first paragraph presumably also wrote the fifth, which reads, quote, but complicating his message are stagnant wage growth, lost wealth, and the stubbornly high number of long-term unemployed, statistics Republicans have been quick to note, close quote. So maybe it's a struggle to convince people who have lost wealth, wages, and jobs that they're on solid ground because they're not? But reporting fixated on out-of-context data and political spin instead of on human beings always seems to suggest that people can be persuaded into giving credit for an economic reality that's not at all real to them.
And finally, most of the time, balance is a journalistic goal that makes sense. But there are stories where the effort to get the other side's take raises some real questions. The New York Times on October 2nd reported on a new study that found that offering long-term contraceptives to teenagers reduced pregnancies and abortions. The study came out just as the American Academy of Pediatrics issued new guidelines on teenagers and contraceptives that offered very similar advice. But as Paul Waldman noted at the American Prospect, the Times included the views of something called the American College of Pediatricians, a group that takes issue with all of this and promotes abstinence instead. It's not explained to Times readers, but this is a group of about 200 or so social conservatives. The group was formed, Waldman notes, as a protest against the American Academy's endorsement of the rights of gays and lesbians to adopt children. Their inclusion is not, in other words, based on any scientific disagreement, but on the need to give voice to a fringe position. Now, it's not that unpopular ideas shouldn't be in the media, but there should be a question as to which ones merit inclusion. The Supreme Court decision to refuse to hear several marriage equality cases meant that five more states were now legalizing same-sex marriage. But in outlets like the PBS NewsHour on October 6th, that meant a let's-hear-from-both-sides debate with someone who opposes extending gays and lesbians the same rights as heterosexual couples. There's a value in opening up media debates, but it's not clear that a discussion of science requires anti-science views or that stories about equality need the balancing anti-equality position.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR.
On October 10th, the film Kill the Messenger will be released in U.S. movie theaters. It tells the story of investigative journalist Gary Webb, whose 1996 Dark Alliance series in the San Jose Mercury News documented the links between major U.S. drug dealers and the CIA-backed Contra Army in Nicaragua. Webb's reporting was at first ignored by the mainstream press, but the series spread primarily via talk radio, and it was one of the first demonstrations of how the internet could dramatically increase the reach of a story that major media outlets would rather not pursue. Counterspin was proud to have hosted Webb several times. Today we bring you the Gary Webb story as told by Gary Webb. We start in September of 1996 when Webb appeared on Counterspin to describe the key findings.
The Contras were selling cocaine to the gangs of L.A. in between 1982 and 1986 to raise money for their war in Nicaragua. And we were able to document this by, first of all, the fact that one of the Southern California distributors, now a government witness, and testified to this at a trial in San Diego recently. And using the Freedom of Information Act, we got contemporaneous documents out of the National Archives that showed that not only was he doing it, but that the federal government was aware he was doing it all the way back to at least 1981 and probably through his entire career as a cocaine broker. And it was fairly simple. I mean, the Contras needed money. They sent these folks to South Central L.A. to sell cocaine, and they sold it to the guy who turned out to be the biggest crack dealer in L.A., a guy named Freeway Rick Ross.
Webb elaborated on this in a public forum in Los Angeles, excerpts of which aired on the show in early 1997.
Let me start out by saying what the series doesn't say, because there seems to be a lot of confusion about that. It does not say that the CIA brainstormed a genocidal plot against black America. It doesn't say that at all. It doesn't say that the CIA masterminded the influx of crack into America. What it says is that this Nicaraguan Contra cocaine ring brought tons of cocaine into California, brought tons of cocaine into the South Central, and sold it to Freeway Rick, who turned it into crack and spread it first through Los Angeles and then through the rest of the country. It also talks about how they were meeting with the leaders of the Contra army. We also discovered that, and Danilo Blandone testified to this when he took the stand against Rick Ross in March, that his first introduction to cocaine trafficking came when he went down to Honduras and met with a man named Colonel Enrique Bermudez, who was the military commander of the FDN, handpicked by the CIA, paid by the CIA to run that army. And Enrique Bermudez told him, "You guys need to go to California and raise some money for the FDN, and the ends justify the means." He testified to that in court as a government witness under oath. So, I mean, that's as far as we got on the CIA angle of it. You know, that's all we said, was that these men met with CIA agents while they were dealing cocaine and just before they started dealing cocaine.
Webb told Counterspin that he took heart in the impact the story was having on the communities ravaged by the crack epidemic.
I mean, I was down in South Central at a town meeting Tuesday, and I came away very encouraged that this story will not sort of disappear into ether like so many other ones do. I mean, these folks are talking about what happened in their town to their relatives and their loved ones. And the difference between this story now and the story in the 80s is now we know who was buying it and where it was going and what sort of devastation that it wreaked while it happened. That's what's new about this story, and that's the part that I think people are finally realizing as they read the thing, is that this is not an Iran-Contra story. This is what happened as a result of it.
And he also noted that the rest of the press was, at that point, not very interested in his scoop.
I've been sort of amazed, considering when you think back to the mid-80s, what a huge problem and a huge crisis that crack was, and how everybody was running around trying to figure out how it got here and what happened, and we passed all these laws, that people would be more interested these days in knowing what was going on. But so far, other than talk radio primarily and a couple of TV outlets in the Bay Area, there really hasn't been a strong interest from the East Coast press.
But that would soon change, as newspapers like the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the LA Times devoted resources to challenging his reporting. These flawed attempts at debunking his series changed the narrative, and suddenly it was Webb who was under fire.
There have been a lot of stories about our series that say, oh, you know, this isn't true. These guys really weren't Contras after all, you know. And then there was this thing in the LA Times, which, you know, our series was based, we didn't use any unnamed sources. I mean, we made a rule that we're not using unnamed sources. This is such an important story. It's going to be so scrutinized. We don't want to use unnamed sources. We want documents. We want sworn testimony. We want whatever we can get. LA Times goes out with a story quoting an unnamed source that says, well, we only think they gave him $50,000. And suddenly that's fact everywhere in the world. You know, if we'd have used unnamed sources, I hate to think what they'd have been saying about us.
Webb was confident, nonetheless, that the truth of the story would prevail.
I think this story is really just starting now to come out. The series that we did was just the start of what we're intending to print. We've got a couple more in the works. They'll be in print before the end of the year. This is not a conspiracy theory. This is not, you know, some people in a back room thinking about how they can smear Ronald Reagan after all these years. This is a fact. These are historical facts. And that's one of the beauties of doing the story 10 years later, is because you've got a paper trail a mile wide.
But finally, his own paper began to walk away from Dark Alliance. Jerry Seppos wrote an editor's note claiming that there were some problems with Webb's series. Webb came back to Counterspin in May of 1997 to discuss the fallout.
I mean, if you look at what he actually wrote versus what these alleged shortcomings were, it's astonishing that anybody has been raising this issue that we're backing away from the story. You know, Seppo says quite clearly in the piece that you know, the core of the story was solidly documented, and the alleged shortcomings that he cites, I think you could apply to any story that comes off the AP wire any day of the week, and have the same problems with it. So I just don't see the need for this sort of public mea culpa, because the story's true. This is exactly what I thought was going to happen when I was told we were going to run this column. And I think, you know, I'll give Seppos the benefit of the doubt that I think he had, you know, honorable intentions in, you know, explaining to readers where he thought the series fell short. The problem is, when you've got a story that's this explosive and this emotional, and the mainstream press is so eager and willing to sweep it away, you sort of play right into their hands.
And Webb shared this advice for reporters who might find themselves under attack for reporting stories like his.
So, you know, keep plugging away, because the truth always comes out in the end, and that's the one thing that sort of keeps me going.
In the end, a CIA investigation confirmed many of the core elements of the Dark Alliance series, but Webb himself was essentially pushed out of journalism altogether. In 2004, Gary Webb committed suicide. His reporting lives on. The film Kill the Messenger opens on October 10th.
A Pennsylvania mother is set to serve 9 to 18 months in prison. Her crime, helping her teenage daughter terminate an unwanted pregnancy. We hear about some of the problems this story evinces: restrictions on access to abortion, people who insist God requires they harass women seeking abortions, those who deep down just don't believe that women should have control over their childbearing. But that's not the only problem with public conversation on the matter. There's also the silence of those who think abortion should be legal, but it's always lamentable, regrettable, to be avoided if at all possible, and maybe it's best if we don't really talk much about it. Enter Katha Pollitt's latest book, Pro: Reclaiming Abortion Rights. Katha Pollitt is an author, poet, and a columnist at The Nation. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Katha Pollitt.
Oh, thanks, Janine. It's great to be here.
Well, the book addresses inconsistencies in the anti-abortion position, as it's often presented. If they really believed every fertilized egg was a person, not to mention if they really cared about every person, there are many things opponents would care about that they express little interest in. But the book is also about ideas that many self-defined pro-choice people don't support out loud, but don't deny out loud either. Like that abortion is what you're forced to resort to because birth control isn't perfect, rather than that it is birth control. What are some of the consequences of abortion rights supporters taking the line that it's icky and scary and lamentable, and it still kind of means you messed up?
Well, I think when pro-choicers talk like that, they're falling into the language of those who want to criminalize abortion. Anti-abortion people say it's really terrible, so it should be illegal. But then you've got pro-choice people saying it's really terrible and you shouldn't do it. You'll probably feel really bad about it, but it should be legal. That's really not a ringing defense. It really accepts a lot of the arguments of the other side and stops, you know, at the last moment. Take abortion is the hardest decision a woman ever makes. Really? abortion is the hardest decision. Most women have abortions as soon as possible after they discover they're pregnant. So that argues that it's not the hardest decision. It might be a painful decision, and it might not be. That's the thing. And the reason pro-choicers do this, Janine, is because they want to emphasize that women are thinking this through. They want to emphasize that it's a careful decision. But saying something is a careful decision is different than saying it's the most agonizing decision a woman ever makes.
Well, and one of the odd contradictions in views on abortion is that it's considered a very serious decision that some women just aren't smart or sound or stable enough to make. And for those unsmart, unsound, unstable women, the preferred course is that they have a child and raise it.
Well, yeah. When you say it's the most agonizing decision, et cetera, you're really saying motherhood is kind of the default position for women, that a woman who, the day before she gets pregnant, has no intention of having a baby for many years, or she has enough kids, or she never wants kids, all of a sudden she's really seriously thinking about, oh, maybe I should have a baby. I don't think that that works that way. And that meme of motherhood is the default position for women, that is the basic anti-abortion view of women. They should always be ready.
Well, you mentioned a point that I think is often lost, which is that many, many women who have abortions already have children. There's a kind of iconic image of, you know, you either are the sort of woman who wants to be a mother and is ready to be a mother at any moment, or you're, you know, anti-motherhood.
The stereotypes of who has abortions are the teenage slut and party girl and the cold-hearted career woman. The actual fact is most women who have abortions already have kids. This is why forcing women to look at ultrasounds, for example, before they have an abortion. I mean, there are medical reasons to have an ultrasound. I'm not saying it's unnecessary to have an ultrasound, but to force women to look at it, to be read government-mandated scripts that describe fetal development. This is so ridiculous. These women, they've given birth. They know what's inside. It's very cruel and punitive, but it also suggests you women just don't know about pregnancy and childbirth, but they do.
Well, media love, as you note in the book, to declare a pox on both houses. Centrism is always wisdom. But what does a middle ground on abortion rights, what would that even look like?
That's a good question. I think that as the anti-abortion movement gains in strength and achieves more and more success in the states, what the middle ground is keeps moving. For example, in the Hobby Lobby case, the CEO of that crafts company who didn't want to provide certain methods of birth control for his workers says emergency contraception is an abortion. The medical evidence goes the other way, that emergency contraception does not destroy a fertilized egg, which itself, an unimplanted fertilized egg is now pregnancy, you know, whereas medically pregnancy has been defined as when the fertilized egg is implanted. So they're really changing the definition of abortion, the definition of pregnancy. It's very strange. And now we're fighting about birth control, something that a few years ago when pro-choice people said, look, they're coming for your birth control too, everybody says, oh, don't be paranoid.
They're going to understand that birth control helps you prevent abortions, which they say they're opposed to. But no, the ground keeps slipping. Well, and that reminds me of a question about polls. Media like to cite polls, but they don't necessarily tell us that much when some people don't understand how bodies work. I mean, if you think that drugs that delay ovulation cause abortions, then there's almost not very much point in asking what you think about those drugs or whether you're for or against those drugs.
Yes, and the question I always wonder about this is, why is it that the anti-choice movement wants to redefine methods of contraception as abortion? Why don't they look at the studies and the science and the vast preponderance of medical findings and say, hey, this is great, we can be for birth control? But no, they don't do that. They find some half-baked study by some ideologically motivated person and say, you see, that's abortion too. And that shows you that it's not real. really about abortion. It's about women, and it's about sex.
And the book is very much about a positive reframing, not just of abortion, but of motherhood and of reproductive justice. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what that would entail and what you would like to see happen in this conversation.
It's kind of amazing to me that what I say is being regarded as so unusual. If you have 1 in 3 women having at least one abortion, you can't talk about it as this sociopathic thing that a few women do. It's a way that women historically and today, both where abortion is legal and where it is not legal, have used to plan their families. And this seems completely reasonable to me. I don't think it's a great idea if we guilt trip 15-year-olds into having babies, or women who have as many children as they want, or women who never want to have kids. I think that the idea that motherhood is such a big nothing, that any woman can do it at any time, is really weird, because being a mother, as we both know, Janine, it's a very big life transformation. Ideally, being a father should be that too. To sort of say, well, you should be able to do it at a drop of a hat, is really demeaning to what it involves to raise a child. Now, the flip side of that is that our society, which basically says, if you have sex, that's like a contract to have a baby, also says, once you have that baby, well, what did you have sex for? Now you have a baby. Why should I care? We do nothing compared even to other rich Western countries. We do nothing to help women who have kids. We don't have daycare. We don't have paid maternity leave. If women are poor, they're just out of luck. This is really terrible. The children are our future. And what women can bring to life, both as parents and as non-parents, is tremendously important to our society. And yet we seem willing just to sort of throw all this away.
We've been speaking with Katha Pollitt. The new book, Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights, is out next week. Thanks, Katha Pollitt, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me, Janine. It's great.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.